Welcome to the Sustainable Ag Writer Podcast, a podcast bringing you news and views about sustainable agriculture from across the southeastern United States. Every show will feature insightful interviews and deep dives into sustainable agriculture topics with farmers, ranchers, land-grant universities, and local food system advocates. Now, here's your host, Brennan Washington.
Welcome to the Sustainable Ag Writer. My name is Brennan Washington, and I'm glad to be with you here on this Sunday morning, February 21st. It was gloomy out, but now the sun is out, and I think the weather's finally starting to warm up a little bit. Well, this is our first show of 2021, and boy, did we have a 2020. I think the last speaking engagement I had was at the National Good Food Network's conference in New Orleans. I was on a plenary session on the last day. It was a Friday on the last day. We were the first session in the morning, and as soon as we finished our session, conference organizers came up and said that they were shutting the conference down. Apparently, the governor had just announced that the state was undergoing strict social distancing requirements. With a conference this size, you just couldn't maintain 6 feet between people. So we disbanded, and I drove on home. Watched over the preceding months, how COVID marched across this country, taking life after life after life after life after life. As I sit here today on the 21st of February, 2021, we are going to hit 500,000 deaths today. You know, that's 500,000 people who will not be with their families. That's 500,000 people who won't have a mom, a dad, a grandmother, grandfather, uncle, aunt. Just gone. In my opinion, somewhat needlessly. Hopefully, we're going to be turning the corner on this soon. I do believe this country's going to get it right, and it will get this behind us. You know, hopefully without too much of a human toll that we've seen thus far, but, you know, hopefully we'll get it. We've got some vaccinations out. You know, your choice to take a vaccination is your personal one. You know, I'm going to take it. I have some pre-existing lung issues that, thank God, have been in remission, but I'm not taking a chance on getting COVID. I'd rather take my chance with Tenation because my feeling is if I do get it, given my prior health experiences, it would be really, really bad. So I am not, I'm going to take the vaccine. But, you know, that's, you know, I understand, especially in the black community, there's a lot of distrust of vaccines. And, you know, a lot of that is well-founded. It's not like people are paranoid. But, you know, healthcare has not been good to us in many cases. So, but I digress. We are getting some vaccinations. And one of the things I'm going to point out leading up to the topic of the show, which is cooperatives, COVID, and climate change, is how these events that we've witnessed in 2020 and so far in 2021 have really shown an extremely bright light on all the inequities in our society that many of us know we were here. You know, we weren't blind to the fact that this is an equal society. But the pandemic and increasingly climate change is starting to bring out just how unequal we are. You know, take the vaccinations. Black and brown people bear the unmistakable and undeniable burden of suffering from this virus the most. And yet when it comes to vaccination, it appears that we are the last to be vaccinated. That I read an article where wealthy people was driving from Westchester County in New York down to the South Bronx to get vaccinated. Why? And this is going to be a subject we'll talk about, you know, both now, a little bit today, but I want to dedicate a whole show to it, is our increasing reliance on technology as a primary means of communication. Now, that's okay for the telephone, where we pretty much ran telephone lines no matter where you were in the country, but internet's not the same thing. So when you need to set appointments for vaccinations by the internet, many lower-income people don't have internet access, you know, either because of, you know, mainly because of finances. It's just something they can't afford. Many households, there's not even a computer. In many rural areas, even if you have a computer, you don't have broadband. So I call it technological redlining, this increasing reliance on providing information and interaction with government services is being increasingly driven online. And that's putting a bunch of people at disadvantages. And we saw this during the aid packages that they put out for COVID, you know, not only the small business packages, but I'm going to talk specifically about the agricultural aid. A lot of that, a lot of the notifications, a lot of the application processes were all driven online. So when you got to rural Mississippi, or when you got to Southwest Georgia, or when you got into certain areas around Baton Rouge, Louisiana, or when you got into rural areas of Virginia, A, you weren't even getting notified about these aid packages. B, you, in many cases, the instructions were not clear. There was no technical assistance to help you fill out the applications. And for our rural farmers, and especially our black and brown rural farmers, this promotes, in many cases, an insurmountable obstacle for them being able to apply for this aid. I think they released some figures, and black and brown farmers did not get anywhere near the percentage of aid that's represented by their numbers. Even though small now, numbers have dwindled in agriculture. But if you extrapolated the amount of funds that were put out there and the amount of funds that black and brown farmers got, it just didn't jive. So we're starting to see these inequities come out. And it's 2021 and we have a new administration. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris got elected as president and vice president respectively. And a lot of people are expecting there to be some changes. I know I am. Just as an aside, I was doing some work, some paperwork, and I had the news on where they were doing the certification of the Electoral College. And like I said, it was watching me. I was more paying attention to the work that I was doing. But all of a sudden, I noticed the tone and tenor of the broadcast had changed. So I said, oh, that's strange. And I went out, and that's when I started to see people storming the Capitol, charging up the Capitol steps, beating cops with American flags, roaming through the halls of the Capitol. And once again, the inequities and the hypocrisy of a lot of things in our system was put on full view, because those couldn't have been Black Lives Matter protesters. In fact, when the Black Lives Matter protesters had their protest in D.C. over the summer, they were met by a significant armed police force. Very significant. You go on the internet and read the and look at some of the pictures. There was a police officer, a Capitol police officer, and I can't remember if I saw it online or if I heard him say it, but he said, had that been Black Lives Matter that attempted what we saw done that day, that they would still be putting toe tags on bodies. So one of the good things that I'm hoping comes out of this, especially as it applies to agriculture, is that, you know, a light's been shown, you know, a very, very stark light. Not that we didn't know that some of these problems existed, but they've now been exacerbated and really, really brought out into the open. And I'm hoping with this new administration that some things will change. So first thing I looked for was who they were going to pick to be the Secretary of Agriculture. And I've got to tell you, I was extremely, extremely disappointed with the choice of Michael Vilsack as Secretary of Agriculture. He served Ag Secretary under President Obama for 8 years. And during those 8 years, he basically was there to support large corporate farms and agribusiness. He did very little for small family farms. He did very little in the way of addressing nutrition issues in this country. You know, a lot of people don't know this, but the USDA's budget is second only in size to the U.S. military. Think about that for a minute, because far and away, we've got the largest military budget. In fact, our military budget surpasses, you look at some other first world nations, you can add two or three of them together and our military budget surpasses theirs in total. So think about how large the USDA budget, if it's second only to the U.S. military, and about 60% of that budget is directed to food and nutrition services, and the rest toward agricultural programs. And I was really hoping they would select Marshall Fudge, who I think would have brought a much needed change of perspective on the agency's priorities. She was certainly interested in nutrition and food services. I think she would have brought a renewed light onto small to mid-sized family farms, and also brought more attention and more support to local food system development. But they sent her over to HUD. And I'm sure she'll do a good job there. So we know what we have in Vilsack. We do have to remember that Vilsack paid absolutely no attention to claims of discrimination, the rampant discrimination within USDA during his tenure as Agriculture Secretary. In fact, I've read as when he was most black farm and black brown farm groups were totally opposed to his nomination this time around. And actually, I'm starting to read some stories about there were farmers who had discrimination complaints active within USDA, whose farms had fallen into foreclosure because of a lot of discriminatory practices of the agencies and the local FSA county boards. They actually foreclosed on some of these farmers while they had an active case. And Vilsack seemed to be okay with that. Best we can do was just really keep his feet to the fire and keep the administration's feet to the fire on the needs of our communities. Monica Range, who's a longtime attorney member of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, was just selected as the deputy secretary for civil rights within USDA. And I think she brings excellent knowledge of the problems facing black farmers, especially discriminatory practices that have plagued USDA probably since inception. So that's the best we can do is wait and watch and see what's done and advocate for what we need. The second political thing I think we need to, keep an eye on during 2021 is the Justice for Black Farmers Act that was introduced by Senator Cory Booker. This act is meant to address some of the long-standing injustices that were perpetrated upon black and disadvantaged farmers throughout the history of the United States and through the practices of the USDA. And the bill has, I've got to take a sip of water because I got a frog in my throat. The bill has a bunch of different facets to it. I read through the whole 70 pages, and while I think it's a good start, there are some issues with the bill that need to be addressed if it's really going to be a transformative bill, which I think they want it to be, really needs to address a bunch of different areas. So the centerpiece of the bill wants to set aside funding to set up a land grant program. It is to set aside money where farmers can come in and apply for a grant to acquire land up to 160 acres. The USDA will be allocated some funding to go out and buy land as it becomes available, and then put that money into basically a land inventory that farms can then apply for. The bill empowers and would financially empower nonprofits to act as technical assistance to help farmers apply for these land grants. Getting a land grant, a farmer would have to adhere to certain requirements, among them being you'd have to farm the land, you'd have to take part in some farmer training courses, you'd have to build a succession plan because the plan has some strong components about how to deal with heirs property, which has led to a majority of black land loss and land theft here in the United States. It provides USDA with some back doors to get in if you're not adhering to the tenants of the program. They can come back in and take control of the land or pass the control of the land on to a nonprofit partner that can then re-grant that land. You cannot commercially develop the land except for putting on, say, a single family house and maybe some agricultural outbuildings. You cannot sell the land for, I think the period's 5 years, and that's something that I had a problem with, because USDA defines a new and beginning farmer as anyone with 10 years or less in farming. And my feeling is that if you're going to give people land and you're going to want them to commit to making this a career, that window should have been widened to the entire 10 years, where you're no longer classified as a new and beginning farmer. The act also provides for increased funding to HBCUs for them to develop new courses of study. I also had a slight issue with this because I really think, given it, this act is geared primarily to black farmers and black agriculture, that a specific amount of funding, probably the majority of what the funding that they're asking, and I don't remember off the top of my head how much it is in the original bill, should be specifically earmarked and targeted to our 1890 land grant universities, the Tuskegee's, the Virginia States, the Fort Valleys, the FAMUs of the world, who since their inception of 1890, their whole raison d'etre has been to work with black farmers and black landowners and helping them to become better farming. Not that I have anything against our wonderful HBCUs like Howard University, but if this is a act purporting to help and support black farmers, that money should specifically be earmarked to 1890 universities. The bill also provides for increased funding to the local agricultural marketing program. And within that program are three programs that fund and support efforts to build and enhance local food systems. And within that program is the Farmers Market Promotion Program, which funds and supports projects that support the direct farmer-to-consumer marketing channel. So farmers markets, roadside stands, multi-farm CSAs, any situation in which that consumer's dollars going directly to that farmer without anybody in between. It also would increase funding to the local food promotion program, which is a infrastructure funding program, which funds projects like food hubs, cold storage, those type of projects. There's also some money in there to do feasibility studies if you want to put together a processing plant. I've been trying to get one of these to put together a meat processing plant in Georgia for the longest. But it provides for increased funding to do that sort of local food system funding. And lastly, it includes the value-added producer grant program, which allows projects to fund projects that allows them to turn their crops or the output of their farms into value-added products. So the whole turning strawberries into strawberry jam type thing, or turning muscadine into muscadine wine, those type of projects. And it calls for increased funding with those. There's also, I don't raise livestock, sell livestock, but there's also a lot of language in there about making improvements to the, I think it's called the Livestock Stockyard and Shippers Act. Apparently, if you raise cattle or any type of livestock, you're really at the mercy of these large corporate packers, and they determine what you get, how much you get, and they claim the lion's share of the dollars when that meat is eventually sold to the end user. So there's some language about addressing some of the deficiencies in that program as it applies to the farmer. So I think it's a good start, but I still think there's a lot of work. If they really want to make this a truly transformative bill, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. I know that they had to reintroduce it in this new session, so they should be opening it up for comments. And I know I've talked to someone who's actually working on drafts. I actually sent my comments to this particular person. But if you can do a search for Justice for Black Farmers Act, you can read the act. You don't have to read the whole 70 pages, but they do have some summary. They do have some summary, a three-page summary that summarizes the act, where you can just get the gist if you didn't want to read the whole thing. And lastly, it's grant season. So starting from right around now, probably until the end of spring, mid-spring is season. A lot of the USDA programs that support small to mid-scale agriculture, the nonprofits in 1890, and land-grant universities that support them, as well as farmers directly themselves, will be opening up for applications. Currently, the Beginning Farmer and Rancher Grant Program, which is administered by the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, is currently open for applications. I'll put a link in the show notes where you can go look at that RFA. That is the USDA's flagship program for funding projects that train and develop new farmers and ranchers in the United States. A standard grant is up to $200,000 a year for up to a three-year project, for a total of $600,000 to set up any type of training program. I've seen dairy grazing apprenticeship programs be set up by these grants. There's an organization here in Atlanta that got some funding to build out and expand their urban agriculture training program. Alcorn State University got one to fund their small farmer training program, which I don't believe they actually had an official program before. So that's the type of thing this funds. And once again, I'll put a link to the show notes so you can go look at the RFA. And between now and mid-spring, Southern SARES research and education grants will be opening up. That's for to do any type of research around sustainable ag. Southern SARES professional development program grants will be opening up. That's our train-to-trainer grant program. The local farmers market promotion program, the local food promotion program, and a value-added producer grant program will all be opening up over the next couple of months. And you can check back to the Sustainable Ag website. We'll try to put them up and mention them in the shows that will be coming when these grants are actually open. The best way to keep track of these grants is to subscribe to the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition's email newsletter. NSAC, as we all fondly call it, is the organization that holds the water for us in Congress to get these programs and many of the programs, such as NRCS, EQIP, funded and to advocate for increased funding for their programs. And every Friday they put out a newsletter that has a lot of great information, especially around policy and some of the stuff we need to, that typically as farmers we have a tendency not to pay attention to until it's too late. Things like policy and what type of laws are going to be being drafted that can affect our livelihoods and our operation. But if there, every Friday when they send out this newsletter, if there is a open grant call, they will list it in the newsletter, tell you a little bit about the grant, and then give you a link that will take you to the granting agency's website so you can view the RFP or the call for proposal so you can see it for yourself. It's a highly valuable resource. The website, for those of you who have a pen and a paper now, is sustainableagriculture.org, but I'll put a link to the website in our show notes. So after looking at the devastation that COVID has wrought upon this country, and then most recently over the past week, looking at just the disaster that Houston, that Texas is becoming, I wanted to put this show out. I actually had taped it a year ago, and it was my first time taping a Zoom interview for the podcast. And I thought I lost the recording or did something messed up. So I told it to our two guests today, I just couldn't find it. We have to do it at another time. But now that I'm doing more Zoom meetings and Zoom conferences, I got more familiar with the software and I actually found the recording, which I'm going to play for you in the interview, which I'm going to play for you in a little while. But one of the things that's coming out of trials and tribulations that we're seeing is more interest in the whole area of developing cooperatives. So the situation in Houston's a good example. You know, Texas prides itself on not having basically being a regulation-free environment for business. So those power companies are not under any pressure to spend the money to upgrade their facilities, to do preventive maintenance, all that type of stuff. They don't want to and they don't have to. So the consumer is just basically a peon in the whole equation. Most of us are fortunate enough to live, you know, for example, I get my electric from Jackson Electrical Cooperative. It's a cooperative in which technically I'm a part owner on. I can vote on the board of directors when they send out the notices. And in good years, sometimes they even send you a little check. It's not a whole lot, but if their income exceeds their operating expenses over the course of a year, they will send out checks. And every now and then we've gotten some small dividends. Not anything you could write home about, but that's the way cooperatives work. As we saw disruptions in food supplies, as we continue to see how large financial institutions take advantage of people. You know, the crazy thing about the Texas situation, a lot of those people, I guess, had contracts that required them to pay market rate, which is fine when the market's doing all right. But due to no fault of their own, people in Texas now are looking at power bills in the thousands of dollars. And in fact, from what I understand and from the news I'm hearing, they pay their bills by drafting your debit card. And in some cases, some companies do it daily. So based upon your daily usage, they will go in and debit your bank account. And they're wiping people's accounts out, knowing that they don't have money. They need money to pay rent, that a lot of these folks couldn't go to work, you know, not only because of what's going on down there in Texas, but because of COVID. And a lot of people saying, you know, we understand that a business needs to thrive and prosper, but, you know, consumers should not be an afterthought in the entire process. So people looking at cooperatives And I'm going to say, looking at cooperatives again, because there's nothing new about cooperatives. Cooperatives have been around as long as indigenous peoples have been on this planet. The whole idea is that you work together as a community to get what you want, pool your resources, and share it together as a community. We've got, for a lot of reasons, which I won't go into here, we've gotten away from that. When this whole pandemic started marching around, I scheduled an interview with Eric Simpson, who's with the West Georgia Farms Cooperative, and Matthew Epperson, who is the executive director of the Georgia Cooperative Development Center, just to have them on to talk about what they're seeing, what the work they're doing around cooperatives, what change, if any, that they're seeing because of these. And this interview was taped quite some time ago. It's still timely. I checked it. But this is before everything that started happening in Texas. But certainly COVID was on our minds when we originally taped this. And what they're seeing and the immense interest now in creating or reinvigorating agricultural cooperatives, taking a fresh look at financial cooperatives like credit unions and some sort of insurance products, retail locations. I know Malik Yakini up in Detroit has just opened a retail cooperative grocery store. And I think we're going to see more and more of these types of efforts happen. It's not going to be all and not going to be the be all and end all at the beginning, but the more these little grassroots efforts can, one, take root, and two, thrive and become sustainable, I think the better off we'll all be as a country. So we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back here to talk with Eric Simpson and Matthew Epperson. Welcome back to the Sustainable Ag Writer Podcast. My guests today are Eric Simpson of the West Georgia Farmers Cooperative and Matthew Epperson, the Executive Director of the Georgia Cooperative Development Corporation. How are you guys doing today?
Wonderful, Brendan. About yourself?
All right. Yep. Matthew, well, did I get well. The full name of the your organization right?
Center, not corporation.
Oh, it's close. Center. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. No worries.
All right. I'll make sure. We'll correct that. Well, thanks for being on the show, guys. And I wanted to have you guys on to talk. So, you know, we're all dealing with this COVID-19 coronavirus situation right now. And one of the things that a lot of us are seeing, and I'm sure some of you are seeing, is that people really starting to pay attention to stuff like where their food actually comes from, the fact that supermarkets now, they had a 3-day supply of this, a 3-day supply of that. And people are really starting to take a hard look, local food systems and just local institutions, even like banks. I'm thinking there's going to be a increased interest about cooperatives coming out of this. At least I hope there is. So before we get started, why don't you guys take a minute and tell our audience about each of your organizations. So Matthew, you started off.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, thank you so much, Brendan, for having us today. Really appreciate the opportunity. Yeah, so we're the Georgia Cooperative Development Center. We are a 501c3 organization founded in April 2017. So we've been around for about, you know, coming up on 3 years. And our work is primarily in technical assistance for cooperative businesses. So assisting with stuff like, you know, pro formas for business, market studies, business planning, marketing plans. However, these co-ops, you know, need assistance in either getting started or maybe even doing a conversion project to become a cooperative business. We're there to focus on the technical assistance, networking with other types of co-ops that we're familiar with in our network, and getting those, you know, deliverables ready for them collaboratively. So hopefully they have a really good idea of, like, you know, is this a feasible venture they're thinking about when they try to start a co-op or not? And sometimes it's most important we're able to say, no, it's not, you know? Mm-hmm. So we have to be kind of the sobering voice sometimes for our businesses that are trying to get started. So providing a lot of the services you might be familiar with, like a small business development center, but we're really tailored to and focused on the cooperative business model in particular, because that's really our wheelhouse.
Okay. And you cover the entire state of Georgia, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Eric?
Well, yes, yes. Good afternoon. And thanks again for having us. And as far as West Georgia Farmers Cooperative is concerned, we are your traditional agricultural producer/marketing cooperative. comprised mostly of farmers and food producers. We founded in 1966, and over the years we've evolved to become a multi-stakeholder cooperative, but still primarily agricultural production. And, you know, of course, the foods and the products that come from agriculture. And we are also our local food champions of this community. So we pretty much champion local food and we champion cooperative economics. And we partner with Georgia Cooperative Development Center. Matter of fact, I'm a board member of Georgia Cooperative Development Center because we share those values. We feel like cooperative economics are the tool and the machinery that's needed to give us economic empowerment and to even spread this gospel of local food.
With some of the talk, you would think that cooperative development is something new, but you could really point to it as it being the original way of coming together and doing business. Eric, could you talk a little bit about the history of your cooperative, how long it's been around, and some of the highlights in the history of the organization?
Sure. Our cooperative was formed in July of 1966 during the midst of the tumultuous 1960s. And our co-op was formed in this area of Georgia, west central Georgia, a county called Harris County, the city being Hamilton, which is the county seat of Harris County. Other cities that people are probably more familiar with are like Pine Mountain, because that's where Callaway Gardens is. So that area is where our cooperative was founded. It was founded by five men. And of course, initially our cooperative consisted of about 80 farm families. They all farmed. And of course, they all had big litters of children. And so the initial cooperative membership was probably somewhere between 800 to 1,000. And of course, the primary activity of the cooperatives was a lot of, you know, was your typical agricultural production, livestock, vegetables, grain. And then the co-op started to enterprise and evolve some of those activities into businesses such as grain mills, and of course, convenience stores, and even eventually a housing. And of course, at that time, it was a mobile home park. It was a lot of cooperative efforts around helping people gain home ownership. A lot of old shanty houses were converted into nice brick houses because there was a lot of skilled labor in the cooperative pool of the 80 farm families. And of course, And the whole objective of cooperatives is to aggregate small individual holdings into numerous other small holders, where you've got then large holdings that you can sell into big institutions and compete. And at that time, we were selling to places like Fort Benning Army Base, which is in the West Central Georgia area, which is just slightly below Columbus, selling into other distribution channels. And even had a feeder pig operation that was pretty prosperous and which was pretty much one of the main economic generators. And some of the people that were influential or that were kind of born out of that West Georgia experience have gone on to become Hall of Famers, cooperative Hall of Famers, like the late, great Ralph Page, who served as the CEO of the Federation of the Southern Cooperatives from 1985 to his retirement in 2015, and then he passed in 2018. Well, he got his start as a young man there at West Georgia Farmers Cooperative. When he came out of college, he was a local lifeguard there which was a segregated black park in Hamilton called McMillan Park. And of course, and he started his work there, rose up, got a job with the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, which later became the Federation of Southern Cooperatives and Land Assistance Fund. And just some history behind our connection with the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, other than the link with Mr. Page. But West Georgia Farmers Cooperative was one of a group of 20, maybe 22 early cooperatives in the 60s that decided we needed a nonprofit organization to lobby on behalf of small rural cooperatives, primarily black cooperatives in the South, you know, during the times of civil rights. And so our cooperative, along with cooperatives such as G's Bend, Quilting Bee, Southern Alternatives Cooperative out of Lafayette, Louisiana, Flint River, and a host of others, formed the Federation of Southern Cooperatives to play that role, to pretty much lobby on our behalf to make sure that we were able to gain access to a lot of USDA resources that had been denied us due to the history of that agency's discrimination and segregation. So that's a brief history of West Georgia Farms Cooperative.
Okay. And knowing the history of those organizations you mentioned, I know you had to compress that down a whole lot, you know, everything that's done. So Matthew, a lot of people, when they think of cooperatives, you heard some of the enterprises that Eric mentioned, they think cooperatives are mainly agricultural, or it's a local health food store that you go in and have membership in it. But that's not really true, right?
That's not. Yep, absolutely true. Yeah. So there's a whole breadth of cooperative practice and history of our country. And you folks really should realize, that it's a business model. So any sector, any enterprise, any scale, even actually, there's single member co-ops, but there's also plenty of like multi-thousand member co-ops as well. So can really run the gamut. You know, some of the largest co-ops in our country, usually typically like the financial cooperatives, the mutual insurance, there's this, world's 300 largest cooperatives. And I want to say the annual turnover of all of them is like more than 10 trillion. So like the cooperative economy is massive for sure, but it operates largely under the radar in terms of like the way people think about co-ops. And it's definitely like written very richly into our history. That's one thing I was thinking about when Eric was mentioning some of the civil rights history. I mean, it's written into the Great Depression as well. You know, like FDR signed in the Rural Electrification Act, I want to say in 1934, and that's what gave birth to the electric co-op network that we have today that actually provides most of the energy across America. If you look at the land mass, I want to say like 70% of the land mass of America is powered by rural electric cooperatives. And so a lot of that network came out of, the duress of those periods like the Great Depression and civil rights. And now I think even today, coming up with how we respond to the coronavirus, hearing stories from like other types of co-ops, like Opportunity Threads, for example, is a worker co-op in Morganton, North Carolina. A group of Mayan immigrants formed Opportunity Threads there. And they've converted their textile operation to being entirely mask production now. So more personal protective equipment, so they've been able to shift their operation to adapt similar sort of situation where they adapted processes in Madison, Wisconsin as well with the Isthmus Engineering Cooperative. So they're a 30-member worker co-op in Madison, Wisconsin. They mostly work on machine parts, but they've actually changed their production to be able to make more personal protective like face shields and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really cool to see like the way that this model is so adaptive and it's in all different sectors and it's always particularly present and relevant, like you're saying, I think in these times of crisis and like really showing up to meet people's needs.
And sounds from what you were talking about with the company that's making the face mask, they seem to have been able to shift a lot more nimbly than some other more corporatized business models to do that type of stuff, which is interesting. Eric, you mentioned the history of your cooperative, but at some point it's sort of wane down, and then you and a group of other farmers got back to reinvigorate it. So can you tell us a little bit about what happened, what caused that slide, and then why you guys are starting to have so much success right now? What led to that change?
Sure. It can just probably simply broken down to generational transition. The last thriving enterprise was the feed a pig enterprise. And of course, just like any enterprise where you got all of your eggs in one basket, and when that market takes a hit, of course, you're going to suffer the damage is going to be widespread. And so once the pork price hit that record low in the late 90s, early 2000s, that pretty much wiped out the revenue prospects of West Georgia Farmers Cooperative, because that was pretty much what they were living on and banking on, because there wasn't a diversified enterprise of revenue streams. And so I came along in about 2011, early 2012. And that was around the time when, as local sustainable organic food was still starting to mature. And so me and a couple of people that were descendants of some of the founders and that were still on family farms, and still had aspirations of enterprise in their family farm, we decided to join the wave of the local good food movement and to change our farming practices to, first of all, accommodate the sizes of our operations, but also to try to align with what the market was asking for and demanding. And so then we started to form partnerships that were, you know, that were some that I was already connected with, like the Georgia Organics of the world, your Global Growers of the world, the people that was doing this work out in the local food movement. And that enabled us to place our brand in that arena and to also to take advantage of scale, because we had a lot of farmers where, as you know, because you and I kind of got into the local food movement about the same time, or maybe 2009, everybody had these aspirations of being this well-branded, small, local organic farm that could sell, you know, the best arugula or, you know, pasture-raised pork. But then when institutions started demanding this food and big customers started demanding this food, we knew that the co-op was best positioned to be able to deliver on a consistent scale. So we kind of created our business model to be adaptable, to have the capacity to be able to meet those kinds of needs. And so we just continued to build on it. And now we're evolving to not only be able to feed those systems, but realizing that cooperative economics is ultimately about local economic control of your institutions and your resources. Now we're trying to create our own systems that we can own and control, so we won't be at the mercy of, so our farmers and our food producers won't be at the mercy of some of those other systems. You know, we want to be agricultural co-ops on the scale of a Land O'Lakes or an Ocean Spray at some point in time in the near or distant future. And the way you do that is by building your own systems, you know, from seed to register is kind of our model that we're kind of working toward now, and all the points in between, distribution, marketing.
Matthew, two of the biggest areas that seem to be having problems right now as a result of this virus, and I think we can all agree these problems were there all the time. We just hadn't had a crisis severe enough to really show how flawed some of this our systems were. But two of the big ones that I see is certainly our financial systems. But the other one is actually, and I have slowly come to the realization that the one thing we haven't done well in the sustainable ag and local food system movement is really pay attention to the retail piece. Most of the attention was paid on production. And then as food hubs started to develop, it was about aggregation and distribution. But still, no one ever sat down and said, well, how do we get this food to the end user? You know, and you know, it's either CSAs or farmers markets. That was it. In your opinion, do you think that we're going to see a rise in interest first of all, have you seen increased interest in the rise of things like the development of credit unions? I don't know if cooperatives can do small banks, and also at retail establishments. I was out in New Mexico. So a cooperative, I always think of it like a 7-Onda. That was the first thing that jumped in my head. But I went, saw one out in New Mexico, and you would have thought it was a Publix, you know?
La Montanita, perhaps.
Yeah. Yes. I believe that's what it was. So do you think that we're going to see more interest in that? And if we are, what can folks do to help encourage that along?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we do already see it on the ground. There's definitely a swell of interest around startup retail food cooperatives, for mm-hmm. sure. Just from the about 3 years that we've been in operation, we've probably seen maybe 5-6 inquiries already, just mm-hmm. totally separately and just in Georgia, of folks who are thinking about this very question of the end point, the end user. How do you get the food to them once we've already done the hopefully sustainable production aspect of it? How do we really get it to the consumer? And can we do that through, most likely through a consumer ownership model? Because that's the way most of them, like 7-Onda, have been able to do it successfully in the past. So there definitely is an increased demand. And I think that's, it's great. In some ways, it's a great problem to have for us as a development center that we're trying to figure out, having the capacity to really dedicate the time, the technical assistance to getting these projects off the ground and working with our partnership with the Food Co-op Initiative, for example. So they put on a great conference that Eric and I both attended called the Up and Coming Food Co-op Conference.
Was that the one up in the Midwest?
Madison.
Madison,
yeah, okay. Madison, Wisconsin, yeah. So, you know, Eric and I both attended that, you know, precisely because we're each working on startup food co-ops. West mm-hmm. Georgia Farmers Co-op has one going on. I worked many years in Athens, Georgia, Daily Groceries Co-op. Seven Ondas on our board of directors. And we've got these, you know, this almost cohort of new startup food co-ops in Georgia. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to, like, all these reasons that we want to be at this conference, you know, so it's a great weekend up in Madison, because, you know, you just get the energy of it, the vibe mm-hmm. of like all these different communities, many of which are facing the same food desert challenges. Right. And they're figuring out retail consumer ownership as a way to, you know, have this broad base of consumer owners, usually, you know, thousands of them, who are investing a little bit of capital each to be able to amass the necessary funds to be able to get together a $4 million+ project when you know, actually the doors are on the stores and we're open for business, you know, and we can actually do that through the community engagement piece, which I think is so crucial now more than ever, you know, that we're seeing people come together. So, I absolutely agree. Yeah, we are definitely seeing that increase. And in credit unions, too. So, you know, that's also, and Eric can speak to that. So I know West Georgia, they're looking at that project, too. I also work at a credit union, so I'm definitely seeing kind of the increased demand as well for those financial services. Absolutely.
Okay. When I first started to hear about cooperatives and I began to talk to farmers about them, I was kind of taken aback because a lot of the comments I heard were pretty negative. I don't want to deal with cooperative. The money always gets messed up, that type of stuff. And I understand all the challenges. So, Eric, can you speak at it from a speak to the aspect of challenges of forming and operating a cooperative from the vantage point of your members? And then, Matthew, I just want you to talk about the challenges in A, forming it from a legal basis and then keeping it going from a business standpoint. So, Eric.
Sure. The challenges for a lot of people that you just described, an attitude that you just described, is due to culture. We live in a society that's, of course, you know, we're a capitalist society. And so we don't know about other economic models. And cooperative economics is a democratic model. We think it's a fair model, and we think it's a model that can, for people of little to no wealth, such as, you know, collectively, you know, according to the data, African-Americans in this country, communities can pretty much take little wealth, aggregate it to get the capital, because oftentimes our business communities struggle to get capital. And that's the way to not only get capital, but to own the capital that you get. So even if you get capital from other places, you're still beholden to that other capital. So the seven principles of cooperative economics, and of course, but in this particular aspect that we're looking at is education, training, and information. There's just historically not been a lot of training, education, and information outside of the cooperative environment to really teach and train people about cooperatives. I tease people when I'm doing these presentations. I always ask the question, who was your favorite cooperative economics teacher in high school or college? And of course, and I never get the answer. And that's by design, because we typically never have them. And so it's culture. These are not economic systems that are promoted mainstream. But ironically, I was mentioning some brands to you just a few minutes ago. They're out there and they dominate the market space. I mean, they dominate their sector, the Ocean Sprays of the world, the Land O'Lakes of the world, Ace Hardware. A lot of people don't know these are cooperatives because that aspect is just not promoted.
Matthew?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, so speaking to some of those challenges, definitely, as you mentioned, the legal basis is an area where there hasn't been a lot of attention paid to the cooperative business model in terms of, you know, the statutes that we've written, and really not written as well. So primarily, like, agriculture co-ops have shaped, you know, the Cooperative Marketing Act that we have available to us in Georgia for startup co-ops, which, you know, if you are an agricultural marketing cooperative, that's the perfect statute. But when you're a consumer co-op, like a retail, there actually isn't a consumer retail law or statute on the books in Georgia. So a lot of times you're having to figure out, okay, well, is this a domestic LLC that we're just trying to, like, configure to work the way that we need it with our operating agreement, or do we actually incorporate in another state, which is actually what both Daily Groceries and Seven Onda did back when they were getting started. And Daily was in the 90s, Seven Onda was in the 70s, but they're in each respectively in Vermont and Wisconsin for that reason, you know, for their, they're actually technically a foreign entity. I know, ironically, we're so locally focused. but yeah. You know, Wisconsin and Vermont entities operating in Georgia, because we don't have those laws currently in place, to try to make it a little easier. But thankfully, you know, working with attorneys like Roland Hall, who's on our board of directors, you know, Dave Swanson as well, as another attorney who comes to mind, these attorneys who have figured out, like, okay, how do we make the laws that we have available to us work, to make sure that they still cover our needs, and really kind of bake in all the different cooperative principles and practices that really keep you operating on a cooperative basis. And also within the letter of the law, you know, when it comes time for your taxes, for example, you know, we don't want to run afoul of the IRS with the way we're doing our patronage, you know, so we also need, you know, really skilled co-op CPAs who are making sure we're doing those returns right. But it is in some ways unnecessarily challenging. And to Eric's point, we just don't have a lot of that. Like even the professional foundation, you know, for more attorneys and more CPAs to be getting training on like how to service cooperatives. So I'm really grateful that there actually is a cooperative professionals guild that has formed, that we're getting more involved in. So thankfully those folks can start to network with each other and say like, well, how do you do it? You know, like, so we're not in silos trying to each figure out like, how do we deal with this legal environment, this accounting environment, and so on. So those connections are starting to happen.
Okay. Now, Eric, you've been successful at, you and your team have been successful at actually growing your co-op. You're adding, every time I talk to you, you've added more members. And what do you think your key to success has been to actually doing it? And not only adding members, it seems like you're adding motivated and participating members. And what do you think your key to success has been to getting that done?
Just like any organization, it's about trying to find the right people, the right fit, the right attitude. And in our case, people that share the mission. You'll often have conversations with people that will agree and they will bemoan and they will lecture about the conditions of our community and the need to come together and to, you know, and to pool resources and to improve the plight of the community. And of course, and then when you show them there's a model that can actually do that, there's a business model that can actually do that. And it's pretty much incorporated in principle number 7 of cooperative economics, concern for community. You can know the cooperative model is the business model that can take care of all of those issues and those aspirations and those desires that people want to see improve the community.
Matthew, Eric has mentioned the 7 cooperative principles several times. So what are they?
we can name them out if you like.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right. So number 1 is open and voluntary membership. This is a great pop quiz. Democratic member participation, member economic participation, autonomy and independence, education, training, and information, cooperation among cooperatives, and concern for community is number 7. So those were last revised in 1995. Okay. And there's actually been 3 different versions of those principles. It's been about every 30 years that they've updated those. So we're actually kind of due right now for maybe... So there's actually a lot of discussion. It's kind of interesting about like, oh, is it going to be a principle 8 or do we like subtract or modify or like, you know, how do we keep up with this idea that like this business model is so diverse, but has a unifying core set of principles and values? And are we adequately, specifically, the main question I've heard is, are we adequately, there's 2 pieces actually, one of which is like environmental sustainability, so like our commitment to sustainable practices, is that being adequately addressed by P7? And similarly with, you know, what's sometimes called diversity, equity, and inclusion, are we actually dealing with racial equity through those cooperative principles? Are we showing our commitment to underserved communities in those principles, even though we know, as Eric has said so richly and effectively, that like obviously those communities understand and use the principles very effectively, but are we speaking to that necessarily in the way that those principles are written? It's part of, you know, unlike the 10 commandments, it's like this is a conversation. You know, it's like we can modify the principles to suit our needs, but hopefully they'll continue to serve us.
Okay, that's good. And Eric, you guys adhere to those principles? I think whenever I've seen you speak, you always bring them up.
Well, yeah, we try our best to practice fidelity, you know, and they're pretty easy to stick to. And I think they're beautiful principles. They're principles that we all should live by. But when you're talking about some principles that you can do business by, I think, you know, that's why we champion cooperative economics with the passion that we do.
My next couple of questions are going to be about the crisis that we're actually facing right now. So just from each of your perspectives, what have you seen as far as the impact of COVID-19 on the constituents that you work with, Eric, and in your case, your farmers or in areas of the supply chain? And Matthew, just from the cooperatives that you work with, what has been the impacts and challenges, and what are you guys seeing on the ground out there? Matthew?
Yeah, so actually, we've done a little bit of a survey. So we've put out there to as many of our co-ops as we can to try to get a sense of like economic injury. And we've gotten some good data, you know, well, I shouldn't say good data. It's not obviously a favorable topic to be figuring out. But, you know, we've got some data about like what the impact has been. So I actually brought that here for us. So we've seen so far an average of a 45% drop in sales year over year. Wow. So, you know, for, you know, where we are right now this April, as opposed to the same period last year, only one of the co-ops surveyed is doing better than this, that they were at the same time last year. Okay. And we've seen lows of 20% or as high as 75%. In those sales drops. At least half of them have lost a major contract, either already acquired or they were anticipating to acquire. 64% have online sales already in place, and 14% are in the process of setting it up. So speaking to that nimbleness about like trying to transition. So most of them are working on it, but maybe not comfortable. Only 7% had an insurance policy that covered lost business income as already kind of their liability insurance that they are already holding. The average cash cushion for making it through the pandemic is on average 2 months, but 57% could not last a full month with the reduced revenue that they're currently experiencing. So they're in really tight cash situation right now if they don't get some of those like the CARES package products.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Are cooperatives eligible to apply for those?
Yes.
Let's not talk about whether they can actually access it, but you at least apply for it?
Yeah, they are, and they are trying to. Yeah, we've gotten that report back. The co-ops are reaching out and not hearing back yet, but they are trying.
And are you hearing the same thing from your similar colleagues in other states?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah, okay. There's a lot of interest and need for both the EIDL and the PPP.
Okay. Eric?
Yes, and as far as on the ground and farmers and where a co-op like ours stand, we were one of those co-ops in that data that Matthew collected, that on the negative side, yeah, we lost a significant contract. But fortunately, on the opposite side, compared to this time last year, our business is a little brisker because we've got the right strategic partners. So we've got partners that are being proactive in trying to make sure certain segments of their local population are being fed, school children, laid off restaurant workers, healthcare workers on the front line. And so some of the restaurant partners and some of the organizations that work with local food reached out to us and included us into their supply chain to get this food into those projects. And those projects have accounted pretty much for equal or more than what we were getting through our normal customer channels this time last year. So it's been a blessing in that regard, because you know we're also able to connect with new people. And so that's been well. But then there's still a lot of anxiety and uncertainty because market season is coming up, growing season is coming up. We kind of forecast what we needed to grow and produce, but not necessarily sure how that's going to, you know, pan out, you know, going forward. Hoping that it will. I'm hoping that it gets better. You know, if we just like everything, we figure it has to get better at some point in time.
Yeah.
And so we are also in the process of launching some online platforms, because a lot of the partners and agencies that work with local farmers and local food are encouraging farmers and organizations that grow food to put more emphasis on this online platform to accommodate social distancing. And so we are in the process of building it out to be nimble, as you and Matthew mentioned earlier, the term that you all mentioned. So that's where we are.
Okay. You think we're going to lose any organizations or any farms?
We're going to lose some. Well, farmers are pretty resilient people. I don't think West Georgia is going to lose any farms.
Okay.
But based on what I've seen in the news, that's very likely, because I see I mean, when you're talking 800 acres of fields being plowed under, that's heart-wrenching. That's food that could feed a lot of people right about now. And of course, these farmers have determined that it's cheaper, you know, just to plow it under because we've got to pay to handle it, even if we give it away. It's one of those things. So I'm sure there will be some casualties. But but one thing about small farm and small farms in the local food systems that we're working in, we were built to be resilient. So I think we'll weather.
Matthew, you think we're going to lose any cooperatives?
I mean, I really hope not, for sure. I mean, from the data that we got initially, it seems like these co-ops are definitely going to hold on and be hopefully be able to weather those storms and be nimble. And, you know, some of them are just closing their operations, unfortunately. Like we're working with like an art gallery, for example, that they just had to close the gallery because they just couldn't, you know, maintain social distancing. And it was definitely considered non-essential. So they're just like, the gallery has to close, you know. The food co-op in Athens also has had to close its doors. So there are definitely these periods of, you know, the brief shutdowns. Most folks, though, have reported that they haven't laid off. I think a minority had done any actual layoffs, but most have reported reduced hours so far. Shifting, to other you know, revenue streams if they can, if they can go online. Another one of our co-ops had to actually stop their production of hot sauce because they depend on a community kitchen where they actually make the hot sauce.
So, that's Abby.
Yeah, exactly. So they had to close that down and probably pecan milk as well, I would imagine. So definitely the way like the supply chain impacts felt throughout the whole chain.
And you think about, you know, it's you know, it's tragic that a lot of these jobs are being lost. And, you know, folks are worrying about, you know, how they're going to feed their families and pay their bills. But below that is a lot of the social good that some of these organizations have done, like Abby Henderson's Gangsta's Growers. So, you know, you have to worry now that those young men, she's trying to put this safety net around and make productive members of society. Hopefully that effort won't be impacted, you know. One of the things I'm hoping to do, and I'm going to be trying to do now that I'm off the road, sustainable ag ain't riding, y'all. Sustainable ag ride ain't right. But is one of the things I'm going to be doing personally is trying to see how we can have these conversations right now. We're in the thick of it and how to come out of it with more resilient models that we're actually working, that we just don't go back to the status quo. Once things get back to get back to normal. So I like to ask both of you, what are some of your ideas on how we do that while we're in that? You know, we're in the thick of it now, which we have to be, and we have to keep our eye to the ground. But what can we be doing now that as we, for example, changing consumer perceptions about things, how do we make that something permanent? And what do you guys have ideas about that? So, Eric?
Well, we pretty much have to continue to do what we're doing. I think we're doing some good things, but we just got to do more of it more frequently, as often as possible. And kudos to you for having podcasts like this that can give us another outlet to reach, you know, another audience that can hear about the cooperative model, because the cooperative model has been a resilient model over years. Of course, cooperative economics are strong in Southern Europe, but of course, you know, it hasn't in our early past. Well, in our early history of the United States, you know, cooperatives were more prominent than they were now. A lot of people don't know Benjamin Franklin was associated with a lot of things, but he was also one of the early pioneers of cooperatives. And so, as far as our local communities. We continue to, I think the message of local food and cooperatives are starting to resonate. We just have to do it more often, incorporated in the many partnerships. And even the work with organizations like Georgia Organics, which is which are advocates for local and clean and healthy, sustainable organic food. Cooperatives are starting to become a topic of conversation within some of that work. And I'm a board member there. So I think we just need to continue to do what we're doing and just do it relentlessly.
Matthew? My definite hope is that like sort of in this, what I call it, zero gravity moment, right? Where like suddenly the economy has shifted and just very quickly and dramatically done so. We're like, suddenly there might be a moratorium on rent or mortgage payments, you know, things that have just seemed impossible, you know, maybe even 30 days ago, you know, things that are now real for us. I hope that in this, you know, zero gravity moment, that like what we're doing when we're suspended in midair is like starting to reach out to each other, that hopefully we form these connections that will still be in place once the gravity comes back and we're back, like you said, kind of almost business as usual. Hopefully we will have built some connections among each other, doing some of that P6 work, which is, you know, cooperation among cooperatives. But really, I think P6 has to be bigger too. We actually have to cooperate with non-co-ops too and figure out like where are these, you know, linkages where we build resiliency with folks who maybe haven't yet drank the Kool-Aid, so to speak. Yeah. You know, we have to keep an open mind about that, that there are a lot of community organizations like Georgia Organics, for example, like that is coming around to the idea of cooperative economics, but it wasn't built to focus on cooperative economics per se. Yeah. So who are these partners? Who are the partnerships that are, you know, that we figure out very quickly because we absolutely have to out of necessity to survive through the coronavirus economically? Can we form some of those bonds and hopefully keep them nourished and strong once, you know, the gravity comes back on so that we can emerge stronger and with a more resilient, you know, stake in the economy, basically, and consider, you know, continue considering these, you know, broader economic shifts too, that are, you know, that are still happening, you know, whether there's a virus or not. You know, they call it the silver tsunami that so many baby boomer businesses are retiring at the moment. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what's going to happen to those baby boomer businesses if they don't have anyone in the family? You know, this is so often the unfortunate case that like there's no one in the family who wants to take over the business. So is there maybe a group of employees who might be looking to buy the business as like a co-op conversion project? Mm-hmm. So can we preserve community wealth? Don't let it, you know, just go away. Don't necessarily sell it to one of our big competitors. Mm-hmm. If we can keep it locally controlled and in the community. So make sure we're holding up those options as we continue to go forward and think about these broad shifts. You know, I think if we're going to get real about cooperative economics, we're going to need to see much larger shifting of the economy toward cooperative economics. Mm-hmm. And I think conversion is one of the key tools we have in that toolbox about like, we need more businesses coming over into becoming cooperatives, and we need to make that process easier. We need more examples, especially Southern examples. You know, most when I'm always talking about New England or the West Coast, you know, it's like, no, we need it from the field in Georgia. So,
yeah. And from a funder standpoint, you know, I think I may have, I'm pretty sure I put you guys. So one of the things we're struggling with at Southern Sarah is money that typically would be spent on helping to fund conferences and trainings and field days and that type of stuff. But that's not being done now, for obvious reason. And the question is, given our legislative mandate, how can we come up with some new ways to help organization and yet not be in violation of what our federal mandate is? So I think one of the things I sent the email about was trying to fund some online opportunities for organizations like yours. But what would you say to people who fund operations like yours, either be it some of your larger customers, organizations, grant-making organizations, or philanthropic organizations? What would you suggest to them in working with you now in this time? You know, how should they be thinking out the box? Should they just continue business as usual? And Eric, I'd like for you to speak to that from the standpoint of some of your customers, especially some of your larger customers. And Matthew, just from the just pure sense of what funders can do. So, Eric.
Well, yes. We would definitely want to impress upon those customers and those funders that invest in co-ops that deliver valuable products such as food, that it's in not only their interest, but it's in the community's interest that these organizations are able to not only sustain and survive, but to thrive. Mm-hmm. Because when you lose your local food supplies, be it small farmers that die because of age and there's no succession, or be it you know, larger farms that, you know, that supply your local grocery stores, your restaurants, things of that nature. When people run out of local options, then they're at the mercy of resources outside of their community, and that's dangerous. Mm-hmm. You know, quite frankly, that's dangerous. So, just impressing upon them that, you know, it's a very well spent investment mm-hmm. to fund local cooperatives mm-hmm. and local food systems, because just like politics, business and economics are local as well. And you have to have these communities being able to be self-sustaining in order to, of course, create value.
Mm-hmm. Matthew.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, when we're having conversation with funders right now about kind of the landscape and the return on investment for the work that we're doing, just like Eric is saying, we consider this the long haul. You know, this was never the get rich quick scheme. This is definitely the get rich slow scheme, you know, to invest mm-hmm. in cooperatives. But that said, I think it's also, you know, it's good for your money. It's good for your heart as well. You know, that it can do both of those things, right? We can do good by doing well. Mm-hmm. And the ways that we do that is by combining that social conscience about the things that we know to be right in the economy, about, you know, fairness and justice and equity, combines with the ability to meet need and present a unique selling proposition that actually functions well in the market. We can do all those things simultaneously. And that's why I think, yeah, the cooperative investment is so crucial, you know, for the thinking about the long term, you know, the resiliency. We keep talking about resiliency, right? So do we want to see these systems be able to continue to meet our needs? And like Eric was saying, do we want it to be locally controlled or not? And that's a real question, you know, like what happens when we don't have any control over the money supply, the food supply, you know, education, politics, any of those things, when we don't have any control in the community any longer, it certainly becomes less about who we are and more about where other interests lie. So I'm echoing, yeah, that is a danger. The cooperative investment, I think if you look at it historically, I mean, it's very strong, right? That co-ops actually, when you look at, you know, from a even just a business failure standpoint, co-ops are actually far less likely as a startup to fail over a 5-year period compared to a traditional for-profit business. So that's just that's a more solid investment, but we have to be able to kind of aggregate the ability to invest into cooperatives, which hasn't really happened thus far. We don't have a lot of dedicated funds beside a handful of them, like the Cooperative Fund of New England, Shared Capital Co-op, and so forth. There's not too many of those ways where you can, like, you know, I think a lot about, say, like 401k investments, right? Where, like, people are putting that retirement funding into the stock market. They're going to continue to subsidize the risk that's inherent in those profit-seeking companies if we don't have a way to channel, you know, retirement funds toward cooperative economics. So we need to create more of those investment vehicles for everyday Americans to be able to invest in a new economy and make that transparent. And there's a lot of folks who, I guess, have a vested interest in that not happening, unfortunately. But that's the kind of shift we need to talk about. And I think, you know, socially conscious philanthropists hopefully are going to be on board with that.
Okay. All of us work in, do a lot of work in very rural spaces. And one of the issues, aside from jobs, employment, and access to broadband, one of the biggies is healthcare. And I'm just interested in if there's been any cooperative approaches to healthcare models in the rural communities. And either one of you could take that.
Well, early on, and like I said, and this is historical. Of course, you know, in the African American community, we had mutual aid societies. And of course, mutual aid societies were these very modest attempts to pool limited resources to be able to help primarily with burials and things of that nature, not so much health care, but, you know, end of life care. Mm-hmm. And of course, but, you know, long time ago when we ate well, mm-hmm. we didn't require as True. Much mm-hmm. hospitalizations. Mm-hmm. And so, and there are some partnerships that have been, and that, matter of fact, there are some health organizations that kind of have a cooperative approach, your Kaiser Permanente's of the world. Mm-hmm. Blue Cross Blue Shield it's not a cooperative per se, but kind of has a cooperative spirit about the way they try to do healthcare. But given that healthcare is a for-profit endeavor and it's so expensive, it's been one of the harder industries to try to cooperatize mm-hmm. than, say, insurance. And so, gotcha. And Matthew can probably speak a little bit better about that than I can. So Matthew, take it away.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely it is. No, to Eric's point, it has not seen as much, certainly in like high profile cases of cooperative healthcare per se. I mean, a lot of where we've seen it has been in home care, for example. So like that's also sort of, you know, so like, you know, elder or indigent care. That's actually one of the most booming worker co-op industries right now is in home health care. And, you know, as the population shifts, not only is, you know, aging demographics, but also the way that care is delivered, there's going to be a lot more in-home care. So like a lot of the worker co-op movement right now is focused on trying to meet that need, which is so undermet at the moment, just by very precarious work positions, you know, underpaid, understaffed home care. And I think that's going to be definitely true in rural environments too. Same thing actually with childcare. So childcare and home care, these giant industries right now within the worker co-op sector, you know, in terms of trying to just meet that need and try to do it in a way that, you know, actually funds people well, and then thus actually boost that retention rate, because they see that the turnover rate in a lot of these healthcare agencies is so high because the wages are so low. Mm-hmm. So if we're not taking care of our caregivers, what kind of care do we think they're going to deliver, right?
Yeah. So we're winding down a little bit, guys. I want to give each of you a few minutes to just talk about, you know, even in light of this pandemic, what your goals are for 2020 and even 2021. What do you think are going to be the major goals for your organization, and, you know, what you believe the future of your organization is going to be like after this pandemic?
Okay, I'll go ahead. Speaking of 2020, as you know, West Georgia, you kind of helped us craft our 2020 vision back in late 2015. And of course, we're pretty much, I can't say we're on track, but we're close to being on track.
Okay.
Because we're starting to do a lot of the work that we had hoped to be completed by now, but we're doing it in a major way. We've got some very exciting projects that we're working on, that we're in the midst of, and that we can do in spite of this pandemic, because, you know, of course, some of the work doesn't involve being out in public, of course, but we're doing some major institution building. We're trying to develop economic spaces in local communities that we can duplicate and that will be models in other comparable communities. And that's pretty much going to be our work going forward. It's just a natural evolution, but it's all based and grounded in food and agriculture, because obviously food is what we need to sustain ourselves, you know, in the world, but it's not going to be limited to that. So we've pretty much done it about as much as we want to do as far as the models and as far as the type of food systems that we want to create. We're just improving on those. But of course, you know, we're planning on evolving from just food systems to community economic systems that will include financial institutions, food systems, food preparation systems. And as Matthew was talking earlier, some of those businesses that have been thriving businesses in a lot of small, you mentioned earlier, Brendan, a lot of us work in rural spaces. And a lot of these businesses have been family-led businesses that just came to the end of succession. And of course, and like Matthew mentioned, it will be a travesty for these businesses, because these businesses still provide critical services, services such as funeral homes, plumbing companies, things of that nature that people will always need. So once we can cooperatize some of those businesses and using the cooperative economics model, we can continue to deliver the economic impact that our communities need, but at the same time providing the basic services and products that they need. So that's the intent for our work going forward. And to build succession, we're talking about those businesses. It's also one reason that we don't see a lot of cooperative activity going on, particularly in our communities, in our African-American communities. A lot of those co-ops were built during the heyday of the Federation, during Mr. Page's leadership. But a lot of those co-ops didn't survive because they lost key members and there was no succession. So while we bemoan succession in other areas, we got to be mindful of succession within our cooperatives as well.
Matthew?
Yeah. Well, yeah, definitely want to say thank you once again, Brendan, for this opportunity. It's been great to have this conversation with you. For us with Georgia Cooperative Development Center, you know, probably our first anchoring goal is to actually have a fully paid, you know, full-time staff position. So it's been a primarily volunteer effort thus far. So really stabilizing the organization with paid work that gives us so much capacity, obviously, to do more of the work. You know, when we do have dedicated paid staff time and folks who are able to build careers out of the ability to provide technical assistance to the co-ops in Georgia. So that's probably our most anchoring goal for the next, you know, if not by the end of this year, then end of 2021. But also it's within our sights to definitely focus on upping our game in terms of access to capital. So we want to see that, you know, if not ourselves, that we have a very significant relationship with at least one revolving loan fund that will be helping to fund these startup co-ops or conversion co-ops. As they're, you know, approaching us, they need funding for feasibility studies, market studies, pro forma development, business valuation if it's a conversion, those types of projects. So capital is, you know, as we know, it's always a thing. So we always need the money. So being able to follow the money and having an actual dedicated revolving loan fund source is definitely within our sights. And continuing to up, so you know, that's the capital access piece, but then also there's the education piece that we hope to pair with it, which is, you know, we continue to you know, ratchet that up as to like, is it, you know, maybe like at least a monthly webinar that we're doing that's kind of a technical assistance, you know, focused training kind of session. You know, right now immediately we're thinking about upping up, you know, your online sales game, right? So how can we boost these co-ops that told us on this survey, for example, actually almost all of our recipients were like, yeah, we would love like an educational webinar about like, how do we get better at online sales? Okay. So how do we like figure out what is the content our co-ops need and how do we make sure that we're delivering it through webinars, through, you know, we're also looking at doing an academy model. So a lot of co-op development centers have looked at like a co-op academy where, you know, we've got a cohort of multiple co-ops that go through an academy together for...
Oh, that's a good idea.
You know, for, you know, it could be short as 2 months, 6 months, however long it is, the sort of a co-op boot camp, you know, that you're getting all the different pieces of, you know, the marketing plan, the business plan, all rolled together with 10, you know, subject matter experts who are each kind of delivering their piece of that puzzle, you know, for each of these co-ops and doing it together. So you have like your peers and like, oh, we're going through this together, right? So we're looking to do an academy model as well.
That's a great idea. Before we leave, I'd like each of you to just, once again, say your name, the name of your organization, and how folks can get in touch with you if they want to interested in the work you do, either your website or any type of information, how they can contact you to find out about you. Matthew?
Yeah. So again, yeah, my name is Matthew Epperson, Executive Director with the Georgia Cooperative Development Center. Easiest way to get in touch with me is by email. So that is Matthew, and M-A-T-T-H-E-W at spelled out Georgia Co-op. And then the letters dc.org, which is our website, georgiacoopdc.org. And go on that website. It's actually my cell phone, the number that you'll see there. So I'm also really easy to reach that way. Okay. So I'm pretty accessible. And okay, you can find us on Facebook as well as Instagram.
Eric? Yes, my name is Eric Simpson once again. West Georgia Farmers Cooperative. I'm the unofficial development coordinator. I'm a board member. And I'm also one of the small farmers as part of the group. And the simplest way to get in touch with us is through our social media page on our Facebook page. We have a website. It's under development now because we're trying to launch the sales platform. But so through the Facebook page, you'll see the phone number. Like Matthew, that's my cell phone number. And it'll come to me, and I typically answer all calls. And my life is that boring, so I get a chance to answer all calls.
The name of the page?
West Georgia Farmers Cooperative. The whole word, West Georgia Farmers Cooperative.
So you're the development director now?
Coordinator.
Coordinator. Yep. That means you're the money man, huh?
I wish.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thanks, guys. I really appreciate this. Some good knowledge, and I hope that in the future I could have either of you or both of you back on to talk about some more specific things, check up on your work and how it's going, and just see how you're making it through this interesting period of time. So.
Yes. No, thanks to you for all the work that you do. And I know this is not on your, this is not something that you get paid to do. This is that you have. And
extracurricular.
And you're one of the food champions that's been doing this work a long time. Yeah. And we commend you and salute you for that. And we want to try to cultivate others.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainable Ag Writer podcast. Please visit our website at sustainableagwriter.com, where you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. If you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Please tell your friends and colleagues about the show and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Once again, thank you for listening to the Sustainable Ag Writer podcast, sustainable ag news and views.